I want to talk about today. I thought about this. I prayed for a while. And normally, on the first day of unleavened bread, we go through leavening and sin, coming out of Egypt. Sometimes we'll talk about the future Passover. It talks about where it says, and no longer will they say, as the Lord our God brought us out of the land of Egypt. It's looking forward to a future event that's going to happen. And with the men here this year that can give sermons and are willing to give sermons, some can and some are willing. We're not pointing anybody out, but I'm sure some of this will be brought up. And so I, not cheating anybody out of anything, but I really think maybe it's just for me, but maybe it's something for you guys too. That while all of that is important, it's extremely important, it's the reason we're here. And I'm not trying to undermine that in any way. There's something, at least it's on my heart, that's important to me, and I know it's on the hearts of some of the other people that are here. And no, I'm not going to go through and explain the intricacies of Hebrew, because I'm a three-time failure. I took beginning Hebrew at the local synagogue years ago three times, and a rabbi kept putting me back in the beginning class. And after the third year, I kind of caught on and said, you know, maybe this is not my one of the talents that I have or that I can. But it was good. I'm glad I went. At least I learned enough Hebrew, some basic things. I can get it out, get a lexicon, you know, different things. And a lot of times figure out when somebody's lying to you. Because they get up, let me give you the first hint. Well, in Hebrew, it says, my ears go up because I'm thinking, okay, is this the truth or is this guy a lie? Because he just figures. But anyway, I don't get off down there. The rest, it's all Greek to me in the New Testament. I can't figure that out either. But so it's not about the intricacies of the Hebrew language. But one of the prayers that they have you memorize and learn and right away is it's called the Shema. It's probably the most. It's like John 3:16. The Hebrew equivalent to John 3:16, okay? Everybody knows that. You don't have to know a word of Hebrew, but if you ever go to a synagogue or even Messianic synagogues, things like, they have you learn how to sing that. And no, I'm not going to sing it. But it is important. I want to talk about a little bit of an aspect I've never heard. I'm sure other people have lots of times, but I've never heard anybody talk, and I've talked about the Shema before. And I've heard other people quote Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 9, 10. But I've never heard anybody talk about this aspect of it. And that's what I want to get into today. But here it is. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And like I said, I've talked about, you know, the doorposts of your house, and asked people, hey, have you done this, you know, and different things. But I want to zero in on something here. And I've heard people talk about this aspect, but I want to concentrate on this today. Verse 7. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. What's it talking about here? I mean, specifically, what are you doing if you're doing what it says to do? This is a way of life. When you wake up in the morning, it doesn't say, oh, make sure your kids know. It says, you should, and different translations use different words, but I think diligently is a good one. You shall diligently teach them to your children. That doesn't mean like, kids, sit down, we're going to have a little lesson. And you say, okay, I'm going to teach you something out of God's Word today. And you give them a little story or something, which is good. I mean, you got to start with them and you start. You know, none of that is a bad thing to do. But diligently teaching your children is more than just occasionally telling them a little story. And believe it or not, the best way to teach your children is what they see you doing. I've talked about this before, but when mom doesn't respect dad, guess what the kids are going to do? When dad doesn't respect mom, guess what the kids are going to do? You're preaching them a sermon with your life. So from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed, your life should be centered around, that should be the focal point of everything. Because even though sometimes it may feel like it takes forever to get them to the age where they can be, you know, like, I don't know if they're going to make it or not. You know, this is going to be touch and go. And then there's the little celebration. You know, we never had to go bail anybody out. We never, you know, had any serious moral issues or whatever it is. You say, whew, man, it's quick and it's over. You can ask anybody that's got grandchildren how quick it went with their children. This isn't like, this is something God would like you to do if you have time. This is a command. This is something, this is your number one job as a parent. And to be able to do this, you've got to have the relationship yourself. Now, we all know that, you know, Jesus quoted part of this. Let's take a look at it. And that this is an important aspect of the law. He was quoting Deuteronomy 6 here. But I want to talk today about what we're going to do if we obey this and if it's in our hearts. It says, then one of the scribes came and having heard them reasoning together, perceived that he had answered them well, and he said, which is the first commandment of all? In other words, what's the number one? Jesus answered him, said, the first commandment is, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. Let me see. It doesn't say, and you shall love the Lord your God. It says, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. So, which part did he leave off that we can slack off on? I can't find any loopholes there. I'm sure people try and find it and look and have excuses and you know, maybe they say, well, we got to do everything in moderation. That certainly doesn't sound like moderation to me, but we got to do everything in moderation. And grace is going to cover it. You know? Not if that's not in your heart. You know, grace covers a lot of things because we all have shortcomings and but it doesn't cover it when that's not really what you want. When there's something else that's in your heart, something else that is your priority, something else that you say, I'm just going to leave that by the side And I'm going to concentrate on the things that I want to do that are fun or whatever, that make me feel good. There ain't no loopholes there. If we really do love God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, and all our strength, something happens. He puts a desire, this burning desire, to diligently teach our children. Now, he just commanded us to diligently, we read it in Deuteronomy 6, he commanded us that we're supposed to diligently teach them. But if we have that in our heart and we're doing what it says, and it's real, he doesn't have to tell you to do that. Why would you want on your own to diligently teach your children how to have a relationship with God? And see, that's why it says when you rise up, when you go to bed, everything you say, everything you do, you're teaching. And if you're doing, if you are a godly person, you are teaching your children. But that's not enough. There's going to be this thing burning down inside of you. You're going to want your children to have what you have. You're going to want your children to have that relationship. And if you don't have it to teach your children, the very first thing you have to do is to get down on your own knees and start crying out to God and begging Him to give it to you. Because you will not be able to teach your children if you don't have it yourself. You can tell them the words. You can do like a lot of people do, you know. And I'm not downplaying any of this because there's a lot of work that goes into it. But, you know, we live close to a place called Crown College. It's a Baptist college that they've turned into like a seminary for themselves. As you know, people come from, it's not famous like Dallas Theological Seminary or something, but there's a lot of people come here, and when you go to some of the restaurants that are close, you can tell who the Crown College students are, because the girls will have long dresses on and modest clothing, and the guys will have a tie on and dressed very nicely. And you know, I've even asked some of them, I said, you go to Crown? Oh, yes. How did you know? You know? And not often, but a few times a year, two, three times a year, one of them will say, you know, oh, yes, I'm going there. I want to enter the ministry. And then sometimes some of them will say, well, what do you do for a living? And it depends on what mood I'm in. So I say, well, you know, if I really don't feel like talking or I don't feel like it's, I say, well, I work on computers, do computer network consulting and that. And sometimes they'll say, well, that's what I do to make money, but that's not what I do for a living, you know. And then ultimately, if it's a younger guy going there, he'll say, well, what advice would you give me? Some of them have said this. You know, what advice would you give me? And if I'm trying, you know, especially if Mary's wish, she wants me to behave. So I'm behaving. And I said, the most important thing you can do is you need to ask God, is this what you're supposed to do? Because I thought, I said, this isn't like you're going to become a lawyer. Or you're going to become, you know, some other professional where you go there, you take the classes, and you learn the correct answers to the questions or the doctrines or whatever, and so you can repeat them. I says, you're going to enter into the ministry. This is something you better make sure that you're supposed to be doing. Because there's too many pretenders out there. There's too many people for the wrong reasons. So you can, and my point of my telling you this is you can tell your children the correct words, the stories, the doctrines, however you want to term it. But if you're not living it, there's a word for that. It's called hypocrite. They can say, you can't fool your kids. You can't teach your children diligently how to do this unless you have the relationship yourself. So you got to start with yourself to be able to do this for your children. To learn who God is. To learn who Jesus is. How to experience the love and the blessings. How can you tell them or how can you try and teach them if you don't experience it yourself? And it's okay. Just like the Bible is written, it's okay. We screw up. We mess up. We make mistakes. The Bible is full of examples of things people did that were wrong. He didn't hide all of that. Even that can become a lesson to them. Yeah, mommy made a mistake here. Daddy made a mistake, whatever. And I got to go and I'm going to ask God and He's going to forgive me. Even the mistakes are teaching moments. But people teach their kids how to fit into society. Everything from, you know, we got to get these physical things for them because all of their friends have them and everybody, and they need it. And, you know, this is just what you do. Equip them with knowledge on how to get an education. 13 years for most people. Some go on and do more, but kindergarten through 12, 13 years how to learn how to read and write and math. And yeah, those things are important, but that's not the most important thing. Well, they got to have an education. They got to go to school. They got to have some knowledge. Yeah, it helps. But you can be dirt poor. Around here, you don't have to go very far. You go up into the mountains, you see dirt poor people. Some of them live in school buses. Some of them live in old beat-up campers with tarps over the roof because without the tarp, the camper leaks so bad. But if they got a relationship with God, they have something that's more valuable than any amount of money. Now, yeah, it's easier if you have money. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not what the most important thing is. So if you have to make a choice, even between school and God, guess what? There's no choice. Or if you have to choose which one is more important. Now, children are important enough to do it all for them, okay? But I think sometimes, even people in the church, we concentrate on something that's not the most important thing. If we love God, we want our children to understand. We want to pass on, because guess what? You know, I got a guy I know, not really a friend, but I've known him for a long time, since the 80s. And when I first started talking and listening to some of his teachings and whatnot, 40 years ago, he would talk about he had a contract with God. He quoted Psalms 90:10, I think it is, about, you know, 70 years and 80 by strength. And he says, at the time he was, he was maybe close to 50, late 40s, early 50s. He had a contract with God. He had 20 more years. And 40 some years ago, I thought, well, yeah, that's 70. You're an old man at 70. That's a long ways off. I don't think that no more, Frank. Sometimes I feel older than 70, and every once in a while I say, I wonder how Frank is still doing this, because I don't want to do it now. But it's not really so far off, so long off. And with your own children, you only have control over them so much. Because I'm told with my own kids, shut your mouth. You know, they're on their own. They get to make their own decisions. But I think, no, they're still my kids. You know, they can get mad and throw me out. Well, one of them can. The other one's living in our house, in a rental. But so maybe she can't throw me out. But she can change the lock on the door and say, you can't come over unless it's to collect the rent. But this is my kids. You have that. And it destroys you. It tears you up when you see them making choices in the world that you know isn't the correct choice. And then you think, why didn't I take more time? And this isn't against my, I'm not supposed to talk about, you know, the kids haven't done anything that I'm up here saying, you know. But you have a limited amount of time with your own children when, you know, they can't send you to your room. It's the other way around, you know. You're going to listen or you're going to go to bed. Take your choice. Over the years, I've seen people with this desire in their hearts. The first one that really made an impact on me, there was a woman when we came to Tennessee in 86. We moved here, and Minister Vernon Boring was his name. He died in 88, and then started, was the minister for the church, and she was the first lady that died that was in the church. But there was this group of women, and they were all related. And I called them the Maryville Mafia. Because these little ladies, you know, they were older, and now I don't, really don't think they were that old now. But at the time, back in 89, 90, they seemed like they were older ladies. I mean, I loved them and everything, but Stella was the only one in her house that kept the Sabbath and came to church. Her husband didn't keep the Sabbath. Her children didn't keep the Sabbath. And her father was a Baptist minister at a church in Maryville. But she learned about the Sabbath and all that. And she had cancer, and she was dying. And about a week before Passover, I asked her, I said, do you want me to come over here? Because she's in a hospital bed at this point in her living room, and she can't go anywhere. And she says, no, you got the church, everybody else, you're going to have to take care of them. I'll be all right. And I said, well, you know, we can come over early, we can come over late, we can, you know, this is important for you too. And she says, I've got everything planned. She didn't tell me what she had planned. But the day before Passover, she got on the phone and she called up her children, her father, everybody. And she says, I got one wish before I go. I want you guys here tomorrow evening. And she told, Mary was there, I believe, the next day we were over there, she told us what she did. She said, they are all there. She says, none of them are going to tell me that they weren't going to come. This was my dying wish. She said, I got my Bible out. She pulled herself up in bed a little bit. She opened it up. She started in Exodus 12. And she says, do you know what tonight is right now? And she told him the story about Passover and how much Jesus meant for her. And her biggest desire was her husband and her son. That somehow she could get them to understand, to know what she knew, and to experience the love and the feeling. She knew she was dying, she was dead in less than a week. I says, what did they all do? She says, they all did exactly what I told them. She says, even my daddy, he got down and he washed feet too. The one thing she wanted, the most important thing in her, she knew she was okay, is her loved ones. Her husband, her children, nieces, nephews. The house was full. She had them all there. Kate McClure. I think she was the second one to die. Stella was married to... Daisy died first? Okay. Daisy had children. Same thing. She wanted to pass this on to her children. She wasn't able to. Then Kate. Kate was successful to a small extent. Her husband, she told her husband, Roy, she said, I want to go to church so bad. Will you please take me to church so I can go? Well, the four of them, the three or four of them each week, each Sabbath, they'd get together and they'd all drive. Usually Wanda drove, but so maybe Kate was being a little sneaky or something, but Royce was retired, and he says, okay, I'll go. He's really a super nice guy. So he started taking not only Kate, but some of the others. And when he's there, they had to drive 20, 25 minutes. So he just kind of hang around and bored and waiting for it to get over. And so then he'd take them all home. But guess what? Kate's praying the entire time, please, God. I love Roy. I want him in your kingdom, too. God answered her prayer. She didn't stop there. She had two daughters that she loved and a granddaughter. And she's praying for them. And she'd call me up and she'd say, you know, the kids need that. Will you do this? Or any way she could figure out to get them involved somehow with church to do something for her, you know, thinking something's going to click, something. Her greatest desire after her husband was her children, that they would have it. And even though some of them, after her funeral and that, I talked to them and they promised they wouldn't be strangers, we haven't seen them for years. Wanda was the last of the mafia, the Maryville mafia, to die. And she, her husband Harley, some of those engravings on the pots and pans, you know, were 1 year up at, I think it was Fall Creek Falls, or Harley, he would keep the holy days with us. He came to church. And 1 year we had just bought a bunch of this stuff, and I had a little engraving pen, and we had to keep it separate from the camp or the state park stuff. And some of you were there when this happened. You know, Harley's out there engraving COG or whatever in all of those pans, so we knew which stuff was ours. But her children, you know, they were all adults and grown up and had their own kids. And some of them, she'd even ask me, my son's getting married. Would you be willing to do the wedding for my, you know, so she, and she's thinking maybe he'll get to know him a little bit, or they can talk about God or whatever it is. But anyhow, when I was growing up, some of you, I'm boring because you've heard this before at church. The thing that probably made the biggest impression on me as a kid is my grandparents. You're not supposed to have favorites, but I'm the oldest of seven children, and as a boy, and my grandpa wanted a grandson, and so they did a really good job with all seven kids and that, but I knew that, you know, anything I wanted or asked, if I could call them up on a Friday afternoon and say, Grandpa, can you come and get me? We lived 100 miles away from Madison. It was about 100 miles. And, you know, he's getting ready for Sabbath, or, you know, he's trying to get everything done Friday afternoon. I said, Grandpa, can you come get me? Didn't matter what the weather was. They were in that car. He was driving down there Friday night, going to pick me up and get me back, spend the weekend, and then take me back Sunday so I can go to school Monday. But their bedroom, their house, it was a nice house, but their bedroom where they slept and the guest bedroom, you know, the walls abutted each other. And on that wall, there was a closet. But it was strange. I've never seen this. You open the closet door in the guest bedroom, and there's your closet. You open it in their bedroom, there's a closet. But there's no wall in between separating the closet. So when guests came, my grandma, you know, had to slide her stuff over a little bit and so you could hang up a few things in the guest room closet or go upstairs. There's a bedroom upstairs. But, you know, I'd stay in that bedroom next to them. And one thing can happen. With no walls in the closets there, and closet doors don't seal all that good. Every night, they would get down on their knees before they each on their side of the bed, and they'd pray. And I'm laying in bed, and most of the time kids are, you know, I'm fighting sleep, and I really don't want to go to sleep, but, you know, as soon as the 10 o'clock news was over, it was bedtime for my grandpa. He said, okay, that's it. Lights out. We're going to bed. And so I'm laying in bed saying, this is really kind of boring. And even though you're not paying any attention, you hear. And I knew they did this every single night, and that's what they did. And they would go through the things that are important to them. But when your favorite grandson, well, at that time when I was little, your only grandson, because there was daughter after my parents had daughter. And he's there right in the next bedroom. Guess what? One of the things you're praying, especially when you know he needs a lot of prayer and you're kind of worried about what's going to happen with this kid. You're really kind of concerned. And I would hear him praying and begging God to take care of me. They wanted me to have that relationship that they had. Unfortunately, they both died and never knew that I had that. So they went to their graves before God straightened me out. But you can't forget those things when you hear that. Do your kids, not intentionally, I'm not saying, you know, open the door and say it loud so that they hear, but do they know that you're in there praying for them? It didn't physically make that much of an impact, but it gets down into your brain. It changes you. You know, there's all kinds of verses in the Bible that talk about fear God. And maybe I'm wrong on this, but I don't think I am. Some people fear God. They're afraid of him. You don't do that because he's going to smite you dead. I don't believe that's the kind of fear that it's talking about. Now, I did all kinds of stuff, and when I did them, you know, the last thing I wanted was my grandpa to find out. But there are also things that I didn't do, and why? He never beat me. He never even punished me. I didn't want him to find out. I was afraid for him to find out if I did something because I knew it would hurt him. I knew it would disappoint him. I knew, man, he's going to be down on his knees now even more. And I believe that that's the kind of fear it's talking about with God, because we're not going to hide it from him. When we mess up, we hurt him first. Mary is the youngest of 9 kids. So now, you know, sometimes the baby gets away, and some of her sisters will probably say that, you know, she... But her parents, 9 children. What do you think was the most important thing for her parents to pass on to their kids? Sometimes it's not easy. And I'm not saying her mom did the right thing, wrong thing. It was her dad made this decision. But, like, one of her sisters got married. Her dad says, we're not going to the wedding. Imagine that. Now, he loved his kids. He would do anything for his kids. But it was one of the older sisters. And he's got all these other daughters and that. And, he's trying to teach them, you know, you got to find somebody that loves God. And this older sister, he loved the guy she married. I mean, I liked him. He was, but he loved smoking. He loved drinking. He loved fishing. He loved hunting. Somewhere on their Bible, and God was not on that list. And he wasn't going to give his support and blessing for making what he thought was the biggest mistake she was about to make in her entire life. And the only thing he could do, she was going to do it anyhow, the only thing he could do is say, we're not going. And unless anybody thinks that, you know, one of the things that that really impressed me with her parents, frustrated me in some ways and impressed me with others, is my dad was a disciplinarian. I knew what the buckle end of a belt was all about at a very young age. And when I started dating Mary, it comes up. Anyhow, her father never spanked her. Not once. Didn't have to. If she knew Dad didn't want her to do something, that was enough. Everything they said and they did from the, when they rose up in the morning till the, it was centered around God. When she started dating me, her mother had a new favorite verse. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world? You know, I'm just, you know how many times I heard that just over and over and over. Because I was this young punk that was going to go out and conquer the world, and money was, you know, going to come my way. And, you know, even before we got married, and then after we got married, my job that I took, I was 16 years old and managing, had lied about how old I was, and was a manager for a local oil company and ran three of their gas stations, and I worked 100 hours a week. And then I really heard about it, you know. She's trying to tell me. To see my own kid, Mary would have to dress her up and bundle her up and take her to work in her playpen or whatever. So that I, because when I woke up in the morning, I got up, I went to the bathroom, I grabbed something real fast, ate on the door, I went to work. By the time I got home, I went to bed. And then her mother tried getting that through to my head. What are you doing? You don't realize. And I know she, you know, that's, she didn't tell me this, but I know she's, that's a stupid idiot. He doesn't realize what he's doing. Jesus wanted his people to know him. Let's look at Matthew 23:37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together. It's how often I, this him talking, wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. Do you think he said that in anger or he said it in pain? Pain. Think about, you know, we read about the stories, what Israel went through, and yes, there was good times, but there was a lot of bad times too. And he gives us some insight as to what he was feeling, what he was going through. He wanted to protect them. He wanted to make them safe, but they wouldn't have it. We're created, you don't have to go real far, it's in Genesis. Whose image are we created in? Those same feelings that we naturally have. Why do you think we have some of those feelings? Those instincts, those desires, those wants. why are you so protective over your children? Mike was talking somebody up here just the other night. We haven't been here that long yet. And telling a story about the year that we met at the Feast of Tabernacles. And it almost went bad really quick because somebody was going to come to him and straighten out one of his daughters. You want to cause a fight? You go to somebody and tell them the flaws of their children or their spouse. Like, I don't know, but that's instant, you know, bring it on. And especially if mom's around and she hears it, you know. God desires and wants to and loves us and wants to protect us. And that's why he's telling us to diligently teach our children, or what? Even if you have it, if we don't do this, it dies with you. It's over. Now, when our children aren't willing to learn and aren't willing to come to safety, like God's children, you know, anytime you think, well, I got it kind of rough with my kids, I got my hands full, I can show you somebody that's hands were more full than yours. How'd you like to be responsible for some of the examples that he showed, flaws and all, that he tells us about and shows us? But they are a gift from God. And it's our responsibility to teach him who he is. In Psalms 127, verse 3, it says, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Yeah, I know when things are going good, that's really an uplifting verse. But when things aren't going so good, sometimes it's like, oh, I don't understand what's going on here. But in John chapter 11, we read about how Lazarus was sick and then he had died. And Jesus came, and first Martha and then Mary had conversations with him. But they were grieving. Their brother had died. And, you know, they knew that if he had only been there, he would have been able to heal him. Their brother wouldn't be dead. And he goes through and he tells them, your brother will live. But they didn't understand what he was talking about. You know, I know that he'll live in the end, in the last day at the resurrection. But he's dead now. And he wouldn't have been dead if he would have been here. And they're crying and it hurts. Then in verse 35, and everybody knows this, what's the shortest verse in the Bible, right? Jesus wept. Yes, part of him crying, I think, was because they were hurt and they were crying. But part of it is he knew the plan. He intentionally waited until Lazarus was dead before he did anything. He knew what he was supposed to do. And nobody got it. Nobody understood. When we read about how evil people were in Noah's time, you know, if you've never been to like Noah's Ark and Creation Museum, you got to go there. It really is worth going there. It's like close to Cincinnati. It's in Kentucky, but and they talk a lot about, you know, how evil the world was and God's wrath, and all of that is accurate and all of that is true. But most people in the flood, they focus on that. Now, there's some things that they focus on that most people don't, that I think are very, very good. Like one of the things is race. You know, they really stress, there's only one race. You know, people are out there, governments and organizations and whatever, they want to divide us all. But there's only one race, and it's the human race. But they do show, and they got exhibits, and, you know, the evil of people and God killing everybody except Noah and his family. But look what else it says, and got it up there in Genesis 6:5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And that's what everybody talks about when you talk about the flood and what it was like. And it says, this is, I think, important. It says, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Why was he grieved? Do you think that he didn't love anybody else? That those other people that had made the evil and bad choices, he didn't love them? He looked forward to it like he was mad. He says, you're going to get yours, sucker, here it comes. He was grieved in his heart. You're grieved in your heart when those that you love don't care that much about God, aren't interested in even learning the little stories that a lot of us learned growing up, Noah and the flood and Daniel and the lion's den. They don't want to hear that stuff. They're not interested. Give me my iPhone. Give me the tablet. Give me, you know, anything. Turn on television. Well, TV's even out of it now. You know, you're going to watch a movie. You know, give me Netflix. Give me Prime. Give me the stuff I want. Don't even show me those little Bible tales on that. That's then. That's got nothing to do with today. You're grieved in your heart when you see this. It's hard and it hurts. And as a loving parent, if your own children or your spouse, somebody chooses to do evil, somebody that you love, a parent, a niece, a nephew, a cousin, it doesn't matter. And you see them choosing evil because they don't know about God or could care less about God. What about in most houses, the younger ones learn real quick to manipulate this rule, and the older ones kind of despise the rule, but there's usually a rule in every household between children. You don't hurt each other. That's not tolerated. Like I said, the little ones will come running, Mommy, Daddy, do you know what so-and-so did to me? And, you know, and sometimes even you find out, well, they were the first, they started it. But it doesn't matter. I always got, you know, and I say, oh, wait a minute. They're not telling you the whole story. And I always got, it doesn't matter. You're older. You should know better. You don't do that. It's the forbidden rule. You don't hit or hurt or even say things that make them feel bad, hurt them emotionally and physically. It's not allowed. So, what's the second rule? Mark chapter 12, verse 31, the second greatest commandment, Jesus quotes it here, the second like it is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and there is no other commandment greater than these. So the two, yeah, there's 613 laws and 10 commandments that were engraved on stones, and everything is important, the statutes, the judgments, the commandments, the precepts. People in Knoxville get tired of hearing about all of this stuff, but everybody likes to concentrate on the Ten Commandments. If you try and keep the Ten, that's what you concentrate on. What about everything else? Yeah, the Ten are the only ones that God wrote in stone with his own finger, but the rest wasn't just fluff and filler material. He's serious about them too. But out of everything that's out there, the two greatest are love God with everything you got and don't hurt my other children. Because, yeah, your neighbor might just be your neighbor, and without getting into the who is your neighbor thing, that neighbor that you are forbidden from hurting is his child, too. So, are we willing to do this? Let's take a look at 1 Thessalonians 5:14. It says, "Now I exhort you, brethren, that those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. See that no one renders evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good for yourselves and for all. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and everything give thanks. For this is the will of God in Jesus Christ for you. Do not quench the spirit. Do not despise prophecies. Test all things. Hold fast what is good. Abstain from every form of evil." Out of all the times I heard this, I was thinking today, when I was over there putting this together, I've heard a lot about abstain from every form of evil. And these are all good things to study and to read and to talk about. Heard a lot about test all things, hold fast to what is good. You know, that's things that are brought up in sermons and studies. And pray without ceasing, probably heard more about that one. Never heard really anybody give a really, really good explanation what that means. I mean, some have, but usually it's like one in 25 times somebody will really hit it on the head. See that no one renders evil for evil. Okay, I have heard that several times, and it covers this. Comfort the faint-hearted. Uphold the weak. Those are just as important as abstain from every form of evil. Be patient with all. That's one I got a lot of work to do on that. How are we treating everybody, from your neighbor down to your own children? In 1988, I attended my first Feast of Tabernacles. Some of you might think, well, that was a long time ago. Some of you think, well, I've been doing this since the 50s, so what? But there was a guy there I met. His name is Art Humphrey. And he quoted this verse. Proverbs 22:6. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to tell you what he said about it. And every year I understand more and more what he was trying to get across. It says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Now, how many times have you heard that? But what Art said really clicked with me then, and it means even more now. He said, the difficulty and the problem is until the part where it says, "and when he is old." It's between when they get to make their own decisions and when he's old, it finally comes around and God gets through to him. He says, it will kill you. But you have to. Because there's always that hope that if they were growing up and taught about God and shown about what the relationship is, how to pursue it, what to do, maybe they'll get tired of being little Frank Sinatras and doing it their way. And they'll remember in the back of their head, say, I want that. Now, Mike talked about a guy that, I don't remember for sure how you put it, but he went to service or something with Brenda, and he said, I don't know what that guy's got, but I want it. You know, the kids say, you know what, this world ain't such a great place. I need what my mom and dad have, or had if they're gone. And that foundation is there, and that's why it's so important. And then, my oldest daughter one time, she quoted, see, we sent her away to a Christian, she did homeschool for a while, and then she went to a private school, Christian school, and one day, she quoted this one to me. It's like, you know, I'm telling her, trying to correct her on something, and don't know what it was, and then she pops off with this one. Ephesians 6:4. Let me turn there. And you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. You know, that one will get you when you're, whatever she was, 11, 12, 13-year-old kid at the time, she starts quoting this to you. And you realize, okay, it's good that she's studying at least, but this ain't fair. The kid's quoting the Bible on me. But we're supposed to set the example. And yes, we're going to fail, and yes, we're going to mess up. But it's a tremendous blessing to see godly children. 3 John 2:2, it says, "Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers. For I rejoiced greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth." Ask any parent. It's what every parent that's a godly parent dreams and prays and begs for. It's not like all this stuff is hidden. And just like God is very protective of His children, we should be the same for ours. Matthew 18:6, this is, "Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he was drowned in the depth of the seas." God's very protective of His children, especially the little ones. And I don't think this is limited only to children, because you can have spiritually little adults. There's a lot of them out there, in case you didn't know. We got to be careful of what we do, what we say, and who we hurt. Last verse I want to go to is something that Jesus did that was an example for us. And I want to ask all the fathers, the mothers, the grandmothers, the grandfathers, if you can get a hold of one of your children or grandchildren, that we end the service with this today. Matthew 19:13, it says, "Then the little children were brought to him that he might put his hands on them and pray. And the disciples rebuked them, but Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me, and do not forbid them, for such is the kingdom of heaven.' And he laid his hands on them, and he departed from there." You know, disciples were thinking, you know, the kids are in the way. Get rid of the kids, you know. I mean, he's spending time with them when there's, look at all these adults. He needs to teach us all. And Jesus, what did he do? We all know the story. We all know what he did. But sometimes the kids are just off doing their own thing. If we don't start, either continue if you've been doing it and don't stop, or make changes today while you have a bigger chance, a better chance to be an influence. When they're going to come home and they're going to see it tonight, or they're going to come back to the room if you're staying here where you got this influence. Every chance my grandma and grandpa got, they'd always figure out a way. I just thought they were just off. You know, all I think about is Jesus. It's all they talk about, you know. And then even tell them, say, "You don't understand. You're old. It doesn't work like that anymore." And I don't. And when I said those things, I know now how much that hurt them. But they try and take that and say, "No, no. You don't understand. You don't understand how important this is for you. We got it. For you. You're the ones that we care about. You're the..." Even if they don't get it, don't give up. Don't stop. And wherever you are with your own personal walk, it's not good enough. Mine isn't good enough. Frank's isn't good enough. Jeff's isn't good enough. Nobody's is good enough. It needs improving. Because the more godly we are, the more we can diligently teach our children and our children's children how to walk by the way, how to live, how to be an example, and how to love our Father and our future bridegroom. So let's, if the kids are, I'm not saying go hunt them down, maybe stop somebody that's trying to run away, but grab your children and let's end with a prayer. So come on. Fathers, mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers.